This program is brought to you by Emory University.
The Associate Director of the CMBC here, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today. We have two of them. We have Dr. Laura Emory, who is an Assistant Professor of Music Theory. Her research focuses on 20th to 21st century music and post-tonal theory with an interdisciplinary approach that draws on philosophy, literary criticism, critical theory, and performance studies. So nice and interdisciplinary, the way we like things here at the CMBC. Having spent 2 years at the Paul Sacher? Sacher?
Sounds good.
Sacher, yeah. Stiftung, conducting a critical study of the original sources, her analysis of Elliot Carter's music incorporates sketch study in tracking the composer's evolution and process. Her work on Carter has been published in the Musical Quarterly, Contemporary Music Review, Tempo, and 20th Century Music. Her monograph on Carter's string quartets is currently in press. She has a secondary interest in music cognition, specifically in theories of rhythm and meter. And we also have Dr. Christina Tseng, who's a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Psychology here at Emory. She studies the cognitive mechanisms underlying how humans understand spoken language. In particular, she examines how listeners integrate different sources of informative variation in the speech signal, such as speaker's tone of voice and foreign accent, during spoken language processing. One of her lines of work examines the extent to which prosody, or the melody of spoken language, conveys informative cues to semantic meaning. Christina teaches undergraduate courses in psychology and linguistics, and particularly relevant to today's discussion is a seminar course called Language, Music, and the Mind, which explores the cognitive and neural underpinnings of language and music processing, as well as the evolutionary relationship between these two phenomena. So please join me in welcoming our speakers today.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for having us, yes. So I met Christina about a year ago when I was teaching a special topic seminar on theories of rhythm and meter, which is really the music cognition. And then I found out through a guest that I invited here on campus, Justin London, that there's somebody in the Department of Psychology who's interested in the same subject matter that I research. So I invited Christina over to come and give a talk to my class, and then we stayed in touch. So we were really pleased when CNBC invited us to come here and talk about our mutual interests here in music cognition and linguistics and psychology.
Dietz introduced us as speakers for today, but I'd like to say that we wouldn't want to be called speakers, or rather maybe discussion leaders, just so that we can hear from all of you as well. We have some thoughts that we'd like to share, which we will do now, but feel free to interrupt with questions or comments throughout the hour.
Laura, you want to start? Disclosing our bias, we just sent to Dietz now. So I study music theory, which is the study analysis of music. I try to find out the question how music works and how it works. But even more than that, I mean, I can study the scores and performances to limit to some of the answers I'm going after. I can apply the theories of music theory to figure out why something unexpected happens and how it functions in the scope of music composition, but I'm more interested in the human experience of it. So why does it make us feel the way it does? So that's what I'm going after. That's where music cognition comes in, combined with music theory, which is actually music cognition is one of the subfields of music theory. One of the interesting things that enables them to process music is the way our brain is pre-wired to recognize patterns and to predict future events, so recall all past memories to predict the future events. So patterns and groupings come into play, and we're pre-wired to do that. The way we memorize phone numbers, the social security numbers, the reason why I can't memorize my driver's license number because just a string of I don't know how many digits, probably 6 or 8 or 12, I don't know, but I've never managed to memorize because it's not really subdivided in any kind of patterns. But in music, we subconsciously recognize certain cues maybe the shape, the contour of the melody, of the shape is broken down because suddenly there's a high pitch or low pitch or a different instrument plays or sudden accent, very loud or something very quiet, or maybe something metrically displaces it, some kind of dissonance. So all of these kind of help us kind of delineate some kind of formal boundaries in music. And it is a kind of groupings and repetitions of these groups and what we anticipate will happen next that actually give comprehensibility to music and what enables to actually hear and understand what goes on musically. And so I wanted to start with an example. You may be familiar with this, Diana Deutsch, who's a cognitive scientist at UC San Diego, with her experiment called Speech to Song. Anybody familiar with that? Oh, perfect. So let's start with that. The idea is that we hear groupings and we kind of tend to form musical comprehensibility even out of the sounds are not musical necessarily. So here's the first example. I just tested it and it worked. And of course, this happened. So I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything either. Well,
everything's still plugged in.
Everything's still plugged in. Does this work?
Yeah. How is this speaker on your computer?
Yeah, you can unplug it and just go from your computer.
In a room the size, it might just be sufficient.
Yeah.
Let's try one more time. No. Okay, I can do it. I can do it off my computer.
Yeah,
if that's okay.
Man,
we just tested it 10 minutes ago and it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
This always happens. Okay, we'll do it off of my computer, so it won't be as loud, but we'll get the gist of it. Okay, here we go.
But they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite.
Let me start from the beginning. Sorry.
Number of times.
Okay.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
Now,
so the idea is that repetition, even random sounds and patterns, recognition of these patterns can be interpreted as musical sounds. So if you want to connect that to, I'll keep talking. Okay. Okay. The theories of rhythm and meter. One of the Fred Lerdell and Ray Jackendoff, a composer and linguist from Columbia University, formalized these what we call the well-formedness rules. Is what helps us delineate these groupings and patterns. And it's something that in music we call the, when they're embedded in what we call the hypermeter. So hypermeter basically means if you listen to any kind of song, let's say a pop song on the radio, and you will hear 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's just basic meter, something that's in four. But when you hear that repeat four times, typically like repetitions of twos and fours, they're preferable over repetitions of threes. When you hear that pattern repeat four times, and then four more times, and then four more times, and then four more times, forming kind of units and larger units and larger units, that's what we call hypermeter, when we can kind of step back from just basic meter and interpret multiple layers, divisions of how structurally something works. Maybe a phrase, then a larger cohesive phrase, an entire section, entire movement. So that's what hypermeter is. We like repetition in music because it leads to this kind of comprehensibility, but when that repetition does not work within the frame of this hypermeter, then it kind of creates this kind of tension And the reason is why is because of the theories of projection. What that means is when we hear an event, our brain already anticipates what a future event will be. And if that event happens, we feel good about it. And if that event does not happen the way you anticipated would happen, then we get some kind of a sense of tension and unease in music. This is, for example, why unusual resolutions, when you go to unusual harmony, creates a sense of, it's like, oh, I didn't expect that, because it kind of messes with your sense of anticipation. So maybe I'll play an example of that. We'll hear an excerpt from Mozart Piano Concerto. And I guarantee that even if you don't know this piece and or heard it, you would all be able to sing the ending of it, because we are kind of pre-wired also to hear this tonal center. So we'll hear two excerpts from this piece. One, the first time when we do get a resolution that we expect based on our prior memories and the way we understand how tonal music works. And because of this, I put it on the board here, projective, we heard an event, and then we have something that's projected, repetition of event, and if it happens the way it does, the first time we're going to get a projection. And the second time around, I'll give you a heads up that we're not going to get a projection. So let's do that. So here's a Mozart Piano Concerto, number 23 in A major, second movement. And this is why I absolutely love Mozart, because he's absolutely perfect in kind of sneaking in this, disrupting our projection in music. Can we all hear? If I pause it there, you all would have been able to predict it would be da, ba, ba. We could hear that. So that was the everything. There are a lot of nuances in there. The grouping, the melodies, but da, 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 ba, 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 ba. So all of these kind of registral disruptions that happen throughout, but our brain is able to adjust to that and recognize this break in melody as one continuous line. But the important thing is that we get the resolutions, we get this basic kind of phrase in music that we're pre-wired to expect. Let's hear what happens when this section comes back at the end of the piece. This is the apra and the projected. There, we didn't get a resolution of expected. It's something in music with a deceptive cadence. So it messes up our sense of what a projection actually is. And then what has to happen is Mozart or composer, any composer, has to go back and fix it and give us a resolution that we do anticipate. So if now we got the resolution that we got the actual projection. I should keep going. Okay. also interested more so than in the movie Get Unusual Resolutions. I'm really interested in music where our sense of hyperbeater gets disrupted. And that's because usually when repetition occurs somewhere in the middle of the phrase, it doesn't adhere to the 4-4-4 phrases. It creates this kind of sense of a loop and an ease because we can't really predict when this event is going to end. So up to this point, we have this kind of downbeat time that kind of flows circularly, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. But what happens when we enter into a loop, our sense of where we are metrically gets disrupted, and then I just kind of you lose the sense of formal deviation. So I'll play a couple of examples of that. Here's one, opening of Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral. It's a very brief moment, but enough to kind of just throw you off and create a sense of when is this going to end, and when are we going to get out of this loop and move on with the rest of the piece. Creates almost this kind of static event. It was something that was kind of moving. Let's say, to use a metaphor, flowing in time. Suddenly we enter the loop, and we just kind of loop, and we're stuck there. And there's no really sense of telling when we're going to get out of it. And then, so it creates this kind of, it's like, oh, you can't project what is about to happen, creating this sense of anticipation. And what happens is when you create a sense of anticipation, that's really the height how to explain it, almost uneasiness, and then when you don't get a resolution, that kind of subdues because you don't get what you expect and kind of builds up again. I'll show another example from a popular tune. Maybe you know this one, Bill Withers, Ain't No Sunshine. And it starts regularly in a song form. We get a verse, and then it's repeated, and then we usually expect to get some kind of contrast. We do get contrast, but contrast is a loop that goes on, and no sense again of telling when is this loop going to end.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
So there's a 4-bar phrase, and we're gonna start again.
Wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And this house just ain't no home.
So we got into the loop of I know, I know, I know, the repetition, and repeats 26 times. Plus it's syncopated, meaning it doesn't happen on the beat. It got the pop, pop, pop. So it's slightly off, plus 26 times, which doesn't adhere to the 4+4+4. So it creates, again, this kind of destroys a bit of a sense of our lineal formal delineation. Maybe to connect to what Christine is going to talk about, the music and speech and language, I think also where clearly music and meter and linguistics kind of intersect is in specifically in rap music. And it's something we call flow. And flow in rap is not just the rhythm of the delivery, but also the timing of delivery of the lyrics. And it serves almost kind of a roadmap and identifying signature of rap artists is in which rhythm they like to deliver their lyrics. So I'll give you a couple of obvious examples here. Here's one by Kid Cudi, Pursuit of Happiness. And we'll be able to hear his kind of signature flow is pa 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 pa. Here we go. Or maybe if I show you an example of A$AP Rocky. So that one was a ta 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 ta. So we can hear how the artists have that's really their identifying signature. If you can take a rap artist apart, is really by their flow, the rhythm and the timing of delivery of the rhythm of the speech. So I don't know if Christina, maybe you want to connect into your discussion.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is something I probably should have mentioned at the start, but. I by no means am a music expert. My interest in connecting language and music comes from some work that I've done looking at the extent to which our tone of voice conveys more than just our emotional state. So that's what we typically think of when we think of tone of voice. But we have examples like if I told you that that talk was so long. That long, the way I said it, implies certain things beyond just the long. It was insufferable. It was much longer than it needed to be. But all of that was said with my tone of voice. And so that characterization of prosody is the way that I've looked at it in my research, that it conveys more than just emotional tone of voice, emotional state of the speaker. And instead conveys information about objects and events in the world. But that conceptualization of prosody, given that prosody is considered the melody of speech, lended me, at least, to think about what the relationship between melody in music is to melody in spoken language. So we'll shift gears a little bit now, and what I'll share is a few thoughts on why might be interesting to look at language and music together as two phenomena. There's been a recent surge in the interest of looking at them together, especially among psychologists and neuroscientists. And on the surface, it's an intuitive connection. Both language and music are complex auditory phenomena. They exhibit tonality, pitch, rhythm, and they often convey affective meaning, emotional meaning. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is say a few words about two things. One, the extent to which language and music might share cognitive and neural mechanisms. And second, to open up a discussion about what the evolutionary relationship might be between these two potentially uniquely human phenomena. So I'll start by offering a definition of language, and the linguists in the room will find this very familiar. I should say that when I speak of language, at least in the context of the discussion, I'm referring to spoken language rather than written or sign language. So language, culturally transmitted, rule-based system of intentional communication that's among individuals. So what's useful to highlight in that definition is that it's culturally transmitted because this is something that we can directly apply to music as well. The same applies to the idea that it's a rule-based phenomena. Music, as in the same way, has certain rules by which chords and scales are put together. The function of music, when we're thinking about the definition, is less clear, and this is something we will return to. So there are different conceptualizations of what the function of music might be, and they differ according to different researchers. Tecumseh Fitch, for example, considers music a proto-language, so that spoken language, the way we know it today, originated from a song-like communicative system. Then you have an idea by Ani Patel, who thinks that music is a powerful human invention. So the comparison there, or the analogy there, is that music might be like a writing system. It's employed in certain ways to alter for certain goals, and potentially to alter behavior, mood, etc. Okay. And again, feel free to interrupt either of us throughout this.
I'm sorry, since you just said that, you kind of breezed past these both being rule-based. I wonder what exactly you mean by a rule in this context. You know, we think of like grammar as having these proscriptive rules that are very clear and imposed, but could a rule be more like a regularity or an expectation, or, you know, what
a
exactly do you mean by
music.
A rule?
Yeah.
I think we mean I mean both. Syntactical rules, rules that govern how we can put together words and sentences and syllables, but also whether or not we think something is unusual or expected. That could be in a semantic way. So if I said, you know, the baby drank wine, that's not something that you would necessarily expect. And it follows syntactic rules, but might not follow, semantic predictability. So I think the analogy to music occurs at both of those levels, the strict syntactical rules that govern how we combine utterances and the predictability unexpected aspect.
Which is cultural, because our predictability is entirely built on the notion of Western music. If you're outside of that, African drumming or Asian modal system, then it's a completely new set of these expectations.
Right. Yeah. When we talk about expectations, this is one avenue where we can draw the parallel between language and music, in that the parallel has been drawn at several different places, and I'll refer to two today. One is this parallel we've been talking about between syntax and either harmonic or rhythmic structure, and the second is between, which we've also mentioned, is prosody, or the melody of speech, and intonation in intonational contour in music. But with regard to syntax and harmony, the reason that folks are interested in looking at these two together is that there's been evidence to suggest that violations in syntactical irregularities, violations in syntactical form in spoken utterances yields or causes similar neural responses as violations in rhythmic structure and in harmonic structure. So hearing an out-of-tune chord, for example, will elicit a similar neural response using a variety of different electrophysiology measures as hearing a sentence that's ungrammatical. That's not necessarily something you would expect unless you were predicting some kind of relationship between how the mechanisms underlying language and music.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when you go to a concert, you hear somebody play a wrong note, you hear that, and it's, do we call it a rule? But in a way, you hear that something was not quite correct. Yes.
And the reason we have that reaction is because we know what the rules, so whatever we may mean by that, are, and we have certain expectations based mm-hmm. on them. Right? There are other findings suggesting that hearing out of tune chords will elicit responses in Broca's region, which is a region that's typically associated with spoken language processing. And again, that's not something we would expect unless we assumed that there might be similar mechanisms that underlie processing the timing and expectation resolution of both phenomena. Mm-hmm. There's another finding that associates language and music in an interesting way. There's been a relatively recent surge in the idea of musical therapy, the idea that music or exposure to music, and especially making music, can have benefits for your language production and your language processing. And a lot of researchers are interested specifically in reading ability, which involves being able to segment, being able to distinguish among tones. So in one experiment, Patricia Kuhl is a psychologist, a developmental psychologist, who presented nine-month-old infants with what she called musical training, where she had parents with their nine-month-olds tap the rhythm or tap the beat to waltz music over 12 to 15 minutes one time. And she looked, across a month, she would do this every week, I believe. But she then compared performance on a task where infants had to detect a mistiming of speech stimuli. So if you imagine a steady stream of ba, ba, ba syllables, and then you either speed up a segment or slow down a segment, that detection is something that an infant typically can do. But what she found was that those who engaged in the musical training of tapping with waltz music were able to detect these changes and predict these changes faster and better than those who didn't engage in that kind of training. Again, suggesting some kind of shared, potentially neural correlates for being able to process timing and expectancy in language and music. Yeah, again.
I just wanted to follow up on your example of the wrong note, being able to hear that at a concert. So when you were explaining that, personal experience can say that that's definitely something that happens. But I was wondering if that wrong note would be as detectable if you didn't already know what the song was supposed to sound like.
Yeah, typically you can tell because of the way that tonality works, which is, in Western music, we have tonal music. I mean, you're always going to hear that home center, the main key, the tonic, and all other notes kind of revolve around. It's a kind of hierarchical order, and you can tell when the note is not a part of that hierarchy. You just either not a part of the sequence, so it does stand out. You can tell, and also often if it's going to be a clashing sound where you're going to have a harmony melody that don't work together, that it's not supported, one does not support the other, which in tonal music harmony melody always work together.
Right. Though,
yeah.
Just to follow up on that, sometimes composers, as in the case of the deceptive cadence, will create tonalities that sound discordant even though they're working within perhaps a tonal structure. So how do our ears process that?
Yeah, well, the deceptive cadence is not outside of the tonal system. It just didn't go to a harmony we expected. It didn't go to the tonic. It went to a different chord.
I'm also thinking of the tritone, and then, you know, what are you doing with jazz melodies with, like, 13ths? And so
yeah, yeah. Well, jazz is not tonal. It's actually modal. And then we're...
What is modal versus
modal tonal? Means that you kind of hear a pitch center. We have pitch centricity, but not tonality. There's not a strong pull towards that note in some kind of functional way, where each chord has a particular function towards that home key. In modal music, there isn't such a function, but you're going to hear that we always kind of come back to one same center, but not in the same strength as we do in tonal music. So jazz music is modal, as is pop music is also modal. But nonetheless, we can hear that center. But even those dissonances, they exist in classical music, of course, but they're treated very specially. There's a rule, to say the rules. Those are grammatical rules, how they can be approached, how they can be, they have to be resolved. So you hear them, but if you hear the pa, I'm going to expect that resolution. We heard it in Mozart. Da 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 pa 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 pa. And when we got to the part, da 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 da, that's a dissonant. But we expect the resolution. So you get that, but there are particular ways, kind of musical grammar, really, is how those dissonances can be approached and how they have to be left. In other words, how they be resolved. So you're going to hear them, but you anticipate their resolution. Now, what happens is one of the really interesting moments in music is when you don't get a resolution. And I think that creates a very unique moments in music because you hear that this, we're just kind of pre-wired because our entire tonal system, our Western music works that way. So even you don't have to know the piece of music. You're going to hear it, and then you're going to expect a resolution. And when you don't get it, I think that's a great, it's really events in music that kind of give you maybe the goosebumps or something like that, right? Some kind of emotion because you don't get the projection.
To clarify, so you keep saying about expectations within Western music, but you're also talking about we're pre-wired to expect this and that. And I think that maybe underlying part of Megan's question is this, the biology and the culture thing. You know, it's like, music sort of built to exploit our biological predisposition to hear certain things and expect certain things? Or is that something that we learn within particular cultural systems and it's evolved in that way? Or probably an interaction, but
I think there are definitely components of both. Yeah. For example, we can all sense the beat because of the neurobiological process in our body that we can just hear the pulse no matter what. But now how they interpret the pulse is cultural. So in Western music, we like twos and fours, and we can, like the waltz, we can hear 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But if you go to Turkey and you can see the little street, the kids on the street just drumming something much more complex, like 17 over 5, I would have to sit down and practice that for maybe half an hour to be able to do 17 notes against 5 equally in time. It wouldn't come naturally to me. So that aspect is cultural. But the fact that we can hear some kind of pulsation and we comprehend meter, which is meter itself is a psychological phenomenon. So it's not cultural, it's psychological. So how we interpret different kinds of meter and rhythms is cultural. But the fact that we just can't interpret meter and rhythm at all is already pre-wired.
I would like if I can sort of touch on a subject that has not come here, which in fact is sometimes where music and language meet, and that has to do, I think, with automaticity and supporting memory. The music probably, I don't know, and I'll be very happy to hear from you if you're familiar with literature, probably it's exactly the meter and the rhythm that somehow support automaticity. So we see that, for instance, our ability to remember text, if it's carried on music, is absolutely fantastic. We see it in pre-written cultures, that people remember the entire Bible by singing it, or the entire Quran by singing it. We see in disorders, either with people with Alzheimer's or people with other problems, or some forms of aphasia, where people are losing language, but they don't lose the ability to sing certain things. It's true for stutterers as well. They don't lose the flow. So there is something that supports automaticity in a way that almost takes it deeper within us and is reliable. And on it somehow carry for me in some mysterious ways languages, text as well. Can you say something about that?
I think that notion that there seems to be something maybe raw and innate about being able to process rhythm and maybe certain melody is what underlies a lot of the evolutionary theories that link language and music. So it's not a coincidence that caregivers of young children tend to speak in a song-like way. Infant-directed speech has melodic qualities to it, much more so than conversational speech among adults. And the idea there, the reason that's important is that for the purpose of language learning, words are more easily segmented, they're easier to understand, it bootstraps word learning. But even more fundamentally, I think because of the emotive responses that music can elicit, it engages someone's attention very readily. And that in and of itself is vastly important for a young child that's trying to learn the regularities of a given language. But I think the point being that feelings like that are what provide evidence for those who believe that music predated language and in some sense was the foundation for being able to use sound in order to convey any kind of meaning, maybe emotive or emotional at first, but then lend the path to symbolic representation, to being able to talk about objects and events in the world.
Yeah. And we see that clearly also in operas, where we have arias, where just lyrical melodies, and then you get the recitative section of the opera, which is really just, the purpose is to just catch on the plot. And it's just really fast, a lot of text, but it's not spoken. It's a recitative, means like a spoken, but it's something between speaking and talking. I wonder if it also has to do with different types of way to memorize things. I know, for example, I play the piano, and there are different ways I can either memorize what's on the page, or I can memorize by ear what's going on, or I have muscle memory. And sometimes the muscle memory comes into play when sometimes, if I sit at a piano before, when I used to play for 8 hours a day, my mind would wander off and be somewhere nowhere with that piece. I would be thinking something totally different, but still be able to play through the piece. My fingers just kind of took me there without even hearing what I was playing, without thinking what I was playing. I still played that piece. I finished it. It's like, oh, I finished, and I go back and practice again. But for vocal, it's probably a part of singing and speech is also the vocal, the muscles that you use also to produce different letters and vowels and sounds. They're connected also how we memorize music and speech, the same way we kind of memorize music and playing as well.
I think it's debated what the mental lexicon is for speech versus the lexicon, so to speak, if you could call it that, in music. So I'm not sure that your representation in memory for a C-sharp note is located in the same space or operates in the same way as, you know, your representation of the word cat. It's possible that we can think about these representations of sounds in these two phenomena as separate, but we can think about how we process them as being shared. So we've talked a lot about rhythmic and timing processing, and that's one aspect that the processes are similar in.
Yeah. And C-sharp would be something that would be a local memory. I need to remember it only that time when I'm playing that piece. I will not have to remember C-sharp really in that context again. So I think Bob Schneider is a theorist and a music cognition scientist who writes about categorizations of memory in music, and which is really enables us, it is the way brain recalls memories, which are stored, the process music. And without it, we wouldn't be able really, well, not just music. It's like when I look at the desk, I know this is the desk. When I look at that one, even though it's a different shape and size, and I have to think, it's like, wow, what is this now? So I'm able to kind of recall, or if I hear a bird chirping outside, I don't have to look outside. It's like, what is that sound? It's a bird. And so certain things are, you just learn, they're stored, and you recall them. And we use that kind of recall different categories of memories. When we listen to music, some are embedded, such as maybe the way our harmonies and melodies and rhythms work, and some are you're able to kind of work with a local memory against that one, recall memory, to comprehend what is going on at a particular space and time as you hear a new piece of music. And that's why you're able to tell that it was a wrong note, even if you've never heard a piece before, because you know what something should sound like from your prior experiences, and you are processing what is going on at that particular moment, and if there's a clash, then you hear that something is off.
I think where the parallel between language and music falls apart a little bit is when we start to talk about meaning and the way in which each of the two might convey it. So there's no question that language has the expressive and referential power to be able to describe an infinite number of ideas with a certain precision that is probably unparalleled. And so that's not to say that music doesn't convey meaning, because I think that so far has been, we've touched on that aspect in a number of different ways. Music makes us feel a certain way. It reminds us of certain things. We associate, you know, national anthems with certain ideas and beliefs, theme songs with movies and TV shows. But the nature of the meaning that it conveys is different. And so I don't think anyone would argue that, a novel, well, maybe. Clearly there are pieces that have, musical pieces that have narratives and that have resolutions. And but the precision with which ideas are conveyed is not something that I think is paralleled.
Yeah, sometimes people call it propositional content. You know, I mean, I can lie, but can a piece of music be not true? Just make a statement about the world that,
yeah.
You know.
There was a big divide in this very topic in the 19th century between composers who were absolute, believed in absolute composition, meaning music that just exists for the sake of music. It doesn't do anything more than that. You hear music and there's nothing extra musical to it. And there was a camp of composers who wrote programmatic music. It's like, no, music can tell a story without words. It seems to just by hearing different kind of melodies and harmonies and themes. And they believe the music does have this extra musical. So that the camps, the two thoughts still exist. Those who believe that music is just music for the sake of music and that's it. And a music that can actually convey stories. But it only conveys a story if you kind of know what the story is supposed to be. So it doesn't really convey a story. Because if you listen to Wagner operas, you have to know what the storyline is in order to understand what the story is telling. But if you don't know the stories, then you're just going to hear it and listen to just a bunch of melodies and harmonies that last for 6 hours. They do,
yeah,
sometimes
although,
more.
although I think, this is true, it doesn't contain the same level of propositional information that you already have to know the ground. But I think a lot of people, language researchers now, are also starting to emphasize that most of what we do with language most of the time when we're talking to each other also relies very heavily on the shared ground. And we tend to think about language as being text, and it's sort of very descriptive. So what we actually do, you have to know what somebody's talking about already or it doesn't make sense during most of our interactions. So that's maybe a little bit closer.
Right. So. And this idea of language being text, I mean, Asian languages, that's not necessarily true because, do you want to talk about that?
More about Asian languages?
Like the intonations and the...
Tonal languages.
Tonal languages, yeah.
Tonal languages are an interesting case to think about with relation to music because semantic meaning, discrete semantic meaning, is conveyed using tone of voice, right? So different pitch contours convey different words. So ma, 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 ma are four separate words. Horse, mother, yell, and I forget what the other one is. Clearly, different. Yet the only way that I've conveyed that is through intonational change. There have been studies looking at Mandarin speakers or speakers of tonal languages and their ability to distinguish among pitches in music, and what the consensus is that those who speak tonal languages seem to be better at being able to distinguish these tones. There seems to be some bleeding across what we're using tone to convey in terms of flexical meaning and musical.
It's true. I want to say it's always a case, but almost always it's the case when I get students who do speak Mandarin or tonal language, they do have absolute pitch, meaning they can recognize any tone out of context just by their frequency. They can just play a note, like that's a D sharp. So there's a pretty strong connection between the two. Were you going to ask something?
I had a question on a different topic. So
no, go ahead. That's what I want to say.
I was wondering if the... the effect you get when you're hearing two people talking at the same time, or when you're trying to read at the same time as you're listening to somebody and you just can't do it, it just breaks down. Is that the same effect? Is there a parallel in music where if you hear two different unrelated pieces playing at the same time? Or, because, one thing you think about in music is that you can, we can perceive several notes played at the same time within the same piece, and it doesn't seem to mess with us psychologically, right? Where you can't really hear three words being uttered at the same time without it messing with you, right? But I'm wondering, like, where exactly is the parallel here, like, between, you know, a spoken word, like, two words spoken at the same time versus two completely different pieces?
Yeah.
Or are we thinking of words as notes?
Right,
or,
because if you think of notes that, I mean, it might depend on what unit you're looking at. I mean, you think about notes that are occurring simultaneously, that happens all the time.
Right,
like,
yeah.
There's or even melodies, if you have polyphonic music, or like, let's say you go hear a choir and you have soprano, alto, tenor, and basses.
Right.
So four different things will be going on at the same time, but it's fine. But as far as hearing two different pieces of music, and we have terms for something similar that in music, when people talk about polytonality, polymeters, polyrhythms, which really means that more than one thing is going on at the same time, we actually can't hear that at the same time. We hear it as one sound that's clashing, that doesn't work together. But our mind actually cannot. What you can do is quickly shift between one and the other,
mm-hmm.
which gives you a sense of being able to hear both, but actually we can't. So you hear it either separately or you just hear it as a kind of a block of sound that clashes together, but we cannot hear two different pieces at the same time and process them simultaneously.
Is that true also of, like, you know, when they do, like, those medleys, like, you know, in West Side Story, when, like, you have the one person singing Tonight and then the jet singing and the shark singing? And,
yeah,
like, all that
it's
coming
not
together,
because
the
same... that's counterpoint. It actually, because
okay.
they all kind of work musically together within a system of tonality,
okay.
they still work together.
Right.
But if I were to play the West Side Story and then play a Mozart, you would not be able to hear
right.
both at the same time. You would quickly maybe shift between the one or the other, or tune one out, just focus on one, or just hear it as just noise that doesn't fit together.
And
it
is
just,
that the
yeah.
same as what we get with speech
it
when
is,
you hear two different?
Because
okay.
you, so in dichotic listening experiments, so you have two streams of auditory stimuli that are coming at you at each of your ears. You don't hear both of them. You have to attend to one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Our perceptual systems are capable of doing that, right? And another example is what we know as the cocktail party effect, right? So you're listening to somebody, and I mean, you hear someone call your name, and you are attuned to, so you hear that signal because it's relevant to you, right? So if you shift your attention because you're either asked to or because of it's a particularly relevant signal, you can dichotomize that signal, but otherwise you hear what we call multi-talker babble, right? Talkers who are all uttering something at the same time. It's really difficult to be able to parse at any level, so phoneme, morpheme, sentence.
So, Laura, when we listen to a symphony and we do hear the individual instruments, are we shifting from one to another and don't realize it? Or it's a different process altogether?
No, we hear it all as a one unit because, and the unit that fits together with that are within the rules of tonal music. So when you hear violins and flutes and clarinets, those all come on one chord, you hear maybe different timbres of these instruments, but you hear one chord. You, for example, hear C major. But when you hear C major against a completely clashing, completely different piece that's doing something totally different, this different instrument, different melody, different harmonies, and doesn't fit within the context of what we expect to hear. The projector gives a projection, then we won't be able to parse the two. You have to do one or the other. So if I were to play two musical examples at the same time, we won't hear both. Your mind will quickly maybe shift between the two, because they're maybe in different keys, different meters, different tempos, so there's nothing really working together between the two. Whereas one piece, even if you hear different instruments playing, they all kind of come together on the downbeat, they all progress, they kind of work together, continue the same melody, the same harmonic progression. So they work together, in other words.
Still I'm asking, if I can parse,
yeah.
and I'm hearing the flute playing one note, maybe, and maybe the violins playing a different note.
Yeah.
And I do go with them. So I don't know, maybe we don't have the answer,
yeah.
or maybe we do
no,
have
we
the answer.
No, we can hear that.
Do we shift between them to do this passing? Like in...
I think that's harmony, though, because I'm going to play three notes on a piano, like da-da-da, I'll hear all three notes. As you hear it as a block, but I can parse all three notes together. So we can hear notes together at the same time.
And you can hear words together at the same time, but I guess where music and language might differ is that there's no good way for voices to sound together, right? So there's no good combination of, you know, cat, dog, and mouse spoken all together, and it's just confusing. It's not as if a certain other combination of words spoken at the same time is going to sound any better. So in that sense, I think, you know, whereas harmonic, or notes that are harmonic, that go together, so to speak, sound better, there's no equivalent in language. But I think we do shift our attention to just discrete units, to the discrete signals, whether or not we hear them together in speech. I think we do hear them together in speech. This is why it sounds so unpleasant.
Yes, we do hear them together, but I noticed, for instance, I've been listening in the last few years a lot to Mahler, and I realized that the more I listen, the more I hear the individual instruments that play. So just this conversation raises for me the question, do I, without realizing, switch my attention from the instrument for just for milliseconds, and then go to another instrument?
I don't have the answer to that, but I think it's the fact that we can do that is remarkable.
Yes.
Because we're speaking on the scale of, you know, fractions of milliseconds,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes, that's right.
And so I think that's not to be taken for granted, that we have that level of granularity in our temporal processing.
Yeah, and also, do you say you listen to Mahler a lot? Is that what you said? Yeah. also, sometimes in events, maybe you're not completely attuned to everything that goes on in the orchestra, especially Mahler orchestras. We have maybe 75 or more players on the stage. But maybe suddenly you hear the timpani come in, and it goes like, oh, I forgot the timpani are here, until you hear a little loud bang. Or maybe when other instruments tune in, and you just hear the flutes, and it's like, oh, flutes are carrying the melody. So sometimes we don't notice everything at the same time, and it helps when something significant happens in music that shifts our attention to that particular part. But as far, I think maybe you are right. We're just so quickly shifting that even when I play three notes on a piano at the same time, I hear that as a one harmony. And if I play C major, three notes together, I would be able to sing all three notes. And the reason I'm thinking maybe that it does require shifting, because a lot of students who are coming into theory classes without prior experience, they actually cannot do that. It's very difficult for them to play a chord, and they can hear usually the top note because the register is higher, but they always have a really hard time hearing the bottom, and even more difficult is to hear the middle note.
I assume that today this is an empirical question, no? That can be tested in studies. Am I right?
It could be.
Yeah, I mean, one way to do it would be to just see if processing, you know, a chord is just is only different from processing a single sound or single note, only in magnitude, right? Is that the only difference between hearing three sounds at once and one, or are there different mechanisms for hearing, you know, multiple sounds together, and what those might be?
Yeah.
You know, so we could look at neural responses both in terms of magnitude, but also in, you know, neural region. And I can't speak specifically to any one finding. But.
And depends. I ran actually a short experiment once where I had three melodies, three lines going at the same time. And I was shifting if the melody was on top, the middle, or the bottom part. And I tested to see how the listeners responded to it, what was the most salient part to them. And it was always where the melody was. So it's not just registral, but it's also what is the most active. So there are many different parameters to what makes something more salient, why we hear something with more ease in music than we don't. But as far as kind of playing just a block where there's no really saliency other than a little bit higher, middle, and lowest, just know that it's very difficult for students to tell. They cannot recognize and sing. If I ask them to sing all three notes, most of them cannot do that. They can
mm-hmm.
sing the top note only of a harmony.
I wonder if studying sign language in comparison would affect how we understand this, what's processed auditorily versus optically.
Yeah.
In terms of like the grammar, I'm separating the grammar and the semantics, and wondering if the rules, the underlying grammar of sound, prosody, whatever, is processed separately. This is why we have a harder time with language, because we're also working on the meaning at the same time.
Sign language is interesting because it's, for one, in a different modality, but it's also more iconic. So iconic meaning that there are signs that represent physically what the reference are, right? So I'm afraid I don't know
signs. Most native signers lose that iconicity. They don't recognize it as iconic.
The reference still, the sign still looks like the referent in that sense.
As you can sign to, you can produce and take in two signs at the same time.
Oh, I see what you mean.
But can you watch two people signing? Like, do you know, have people done these studies? Like, can you watch two people signing at the same time and understand both of them? Or is that, do you run into a similar problem?
Like, I don't know if two people, but two people, one person can produce two signs at the same time.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Just, I mean, because of
Too simultaneous. Yeah, in the visual modality, you might have a little bit more flexibility.
But I wonder if it would tell us anything about what we're doing with music.
I'm not sure of the temporal unfolding of sign language, and that if that happens at a slower rate than spoken language,
I think the propositional content is the same.
It is, in terms of
the rate of
expression.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that weren't the case, it'd be an interesting test case, too, to see if it's just a matter of granularity of time chunk, right? But
so testing this empirically would be maybe eye tracking, to see how the listener or the hearer, whatever, in a generic meaning, is looking at someone who simultaneously signs two different signs and see if there is a shift of attention between them.
Well, we know that they can comprehend it, so, you know, whether they're foveating or not, they're seeing it. But it's less serial, it would seem to me. It's got a greater dimensionality at any one time that you can exploit for information. So that, whereas the language or the auditory signal is very linear, so it has and relies on the rapidity, I think, more so.
We've
run over. Like, I'm sure we could go on forever, but thank you very much.
One was about tonality and emotion. I mean, within Western tonality, we would still preserve the notion that major and minor have somewhat different emotional connotations. I happen to be interested in ancient Greek, and Greek was originally a tonal language. Then switched to a stressed language, probably as more and more non-native speakers had to learn Greek and work from it. And they also had more mode, we know that they had within their own theory notions that there were several different emotional organizations with these multiple tonalities. Plato wrote about it, but other people talked about it. His is forward looking. Other people are just talking about response to say that one is more solemn, one is more festive, one is more beautiful, and so forth. And this does at some level seem to reflect more cliche. One question is that only culturally learned as our emotional associations are.